Hi, this is Todd. I know on this Thursday you were hoping to hear from Dan Zwicker and Matt Bennett along with Mike Tenor. Unfortunately, I was traveling for a Thursday morning, and while I'd planned to make it back to do the program live, couldn't manage that, so we had to put together something else for you for the afternoon. I hope you understand.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
From the land of Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason out of the office this afternoon. Coming up during our program today, we'll talk with Purdue Extension agricultural economist Mike Bolje about the opportunities that a downturn in the agricultural economy might afford farmers and others in agribusiness. Closing Market Report, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find us online at WILLAG.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Again, just a reminder that I'm out of the office this afternoon, so no update of the commodity markets. Our term of the day is hedge as it relates to agricultural commodity price hedging. A typical hedger might be a commercial farmer, so the market value of wheat, for instance, and other crops fluctuates constantly as supply and demand for them vary, with occasional large moves in either direction. Based on current prices and forecast levels at harvest time, the farmer might decide that planting wheat, for instance, is a good idea one season, but the forecast prices are only that, forecast. Once the farmer plants wheat, he's committed to it for the entire season. If the actual price of wheat greatly rises between planting and harvest, the farmer stands to make a lot of unexpected money. But if the actual price drops by harvest time, he could be ruined. If at planting time the farmer sells a number of wheat futures contracts equivalent to his anticipated crop size, he effectively locks in the price of wheat at that time. The contract is an agreement to deliver a certain number of bushels of wheat to a specified place on a certain date in the future for a certain fixed price. The farmer has hedged his exposure to wheat prices. He no longer cares whether the current price rises or falls because he is guaranteed a price by the contract. He no longer needs to worry about being ruined by a low wheat price at harvest time, but he also gives up the chance at making extra money from a high wheat price at harvest time. However, in the case of a farmer, it must be noted that the hedge introduces another kind of risk. If the farmer has contracted to sell all his expected crop but then has a bad year, for instance, a year with lower than expected yields, such that his farm is not able to produce the committed quantity, he may have to purchase replacement crop at a disadvantageous price to fulfill his futures contract. And that's our trading term for the day, hedge, as it relates to agricultural commodities.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you. I mean it. Really. Thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with five other voices, Joe Vaklovic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the closing market report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzalem. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the closing market report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, both Jim Angel and Eric Snodgrass. WillAg.org. We think it's one of the most comprehensive places that you can find information about markets and weather and agricultural news. Oh, and thank you. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at AgriGold.com.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. This is the closing market report from Illinois Public Media. You know, since the late 1960s, Purdue University has been hosting its annual Top Farmer Conference. It's targeted at those producers who are at the top of their game and are most likely to want to expand. The conference is held each and every summer, and for a couple of decades now, Mike Boljame, Purdue University agricultural economist, has been making presentations at the conference. He now joins us to discuss his 2016 options. What did you tell them this year, Mike?
Well, we were talking to the producers about the opportunities that they need to be thinking about as we move forward with the changes in the industry. A lot of the discussion we have right now is the downside and the financial stress that many are encountering, and we wanted to make sure we put in front of them that there are always opportunities in any cyclical industry, and sometimes the best opportunities come when we're in the downside of the cycle. And so that's what we really focused on.
I can remember coming to these over the years, and some of the topics, in fact, I still recall. The five-year plan, the first in, first out of any new entrepreneurial type of event. Also, 1 year covering it works here. What if I duplicate it? Should I duplicate this process north and south, or do I duplicate my farm east and west geographically? Yep. As the size that seems to work for me, right, rather than trying to build out in one place, right, building out in several places. Right. So what kinds of things did you tell them this year?
Yeah. Well, so what we did this year is start at a fairly fundamental basic level to kind of make sure that they don't necessarily start with trying to get the answer before they've asked the right question. And that was really, and then the right preliminary assessment. So we really first focused on this issue of, really doing a really critical self-appraisal. And so where are you in terms of your, not just your capital and your funding base for expanding, growing, and changing in your business, which is important, but also thinking seriously about what your capacity, capability, skill set is to do that. And what we find, the reason we did that was we find a fair number of people have a tendency to grow their business by acquiring capital assets first, building a new dairy facility, expanding their pork operation, renting and or buying some new farmland, and then, oh, wait a minute here, I'm already fully employed. How are we going to get this run? How are we going to get this managed? And it's not necessarily the people doing the work in the fields or in the barn that we're so worried about. If you expand your business, unless you're underemployed as a manager, which most farmers aren't, that means that you got more responsibility and more decisions you got to make on a bigger business. And so you better have capacity within the organization. Either you as the CEO of the company, or you need to have a staff that can actually make sure it gets done well. Otherwise, what happens is the first 2 or 3 years, you find that the performance just isn't there at the level you need. And you already almost always in any new business or growth phase, you have startup cost, and you have a phase that you actually don't make money, you lose money, and usually cash flows are negative for the first 12 to 24 months, even if you've got everything in place, just to getting on top of it, getting the systems in place. And if you have, if you're trying to do that without adding to your managerial skill sets or have a staff to do that, that extends that period of time, and that's why good studies show that the highest frequency of failures in any business are during their early growth phases, that they actually try to grow too fast or try to without adding to their managerial capacity to do that.
Did you give them some ways to do a self-assessment or to get themselves prepped for the potential opportunities that might open up for expansion then?
Yeah, so that's great. That's exactly what we did. So we gave them kind of a structure of how they ought to think about this whole process. And we started out, again, where many of them don't start out, and that is we said, if this opportunity that you have, does it strategically fit with your business as it is right now? Is it a strategic fit? And then we said, financially, are you positioned well to do this? And you do financial feasibility analysis. You do some analysis of the costs and returns. If you get even more sophisticated, you do a discounted cash flow, and you do some of that kind of analysis. You look at whether you got the repayment capacity and the ability in the current operation to cover that shortfall in cash you're going to have for the first 2 or 3 years, so you can make sure that you've got, in the vernacular, some subsidy to make it through that period of time. We have a structure where we say, okay, is it a cultural fit? I mean, there's nothing worse than getting into a business that may have real opportunity, but your workforce says, I don't want to do this, and or I don't believe in it. I mean, and the place where we see have that happening right now is when people try to get in organic work. And their whole workforce says, we think organic is not a good idea at all. We don't see why people buy organic food, and I'm producing this. I can't get up in the morning and come to work and say, this is the most exciting job I've ever had, type of thing. So is it a cultural fit with the workforce as well with the organization, et cetera? So we actually have a little template that we use to kind of think about the what we call a venture capital assessment procedure that we go through, that we talk through with them on that. But we also did, to your point, another thing which I think is really important, we actually asked the group to identify the five options that they have either thought about or should be thinking about in terms of opportunities, growth opportunities in the next 2 to 3 years. And I asked the question of the group, how many of you have got this list of five opportunities identified? And not too many people raised their hand. So we said, okay, let's just pause a moment here and write them down. What are the opportunities that you really ought to be thinking seriously about pursuing? And that's a really important part of this period of time we're in, is that we get most of our mental energy focused on how do we kind of manage the financial side of the downturn and make sure that we can make it through this period of time. And I'm not going to suggest at all that isn't important. We really have to make sure that we have the financial resiliency to be able to handle this downturn. But let's don't take that opportunity side off the ledger off the table at all, because some of the best opportunities come when other people are hunkered down and you're the one that's more interested in opportunities and well-positioned to take advantage of them. You can buy equipment and machinery today at typically even almost close to new for 20 to 30% lower prices than you were on the used market than you might have bought that a year ago. There will be land for sale that's going to be cheaper than it has been. There are opportunities in the state of Indiana and in the Eastern Corn Belt to expand the pork operations with new packing plants coming in. That's not been something that people really could seriously have thought about 4 years ago. We didn't have the capacity, packing plant capacity. There's new opportunities in terms of specialty products, non-GMO corn, organic, a whole lot of things in terms of differentiated types of products that are there that are being introduced into the market. And there will be, we think, a lot of churn in the rental market. There's going to be property that will be given up. And so there's going to be opportunities to rent land that you might not have had a chance to rent 3 or 4 years ago. So there's just a lot of opportunity, and you don't wait for opportunity to come to you. You go seek out opportunity. And so it's really important to get your mindset set for the opportunities we have and then think about what we call a screening sheet or a set of criteria to kind of sort through the opportunities so that you don't end up chasing the first one because you think you're not going to get another one, and or that you can sort through the seven that you're going to have and figure out which is the one or two that fit best in your organization and your operation.
I'll get back to the screening sheet in just a moment, but quickly, can you tick off kind of the things that an owner might want to assess in their operations that would be things they need to have in place to get them set to make an expansion of some sort?
Yep. So first thing that we think is really critical, and again, is the part that maybe in many cases is second, third, or fourth, or sometimes ignored on the list of what do I have to have in place, is to have the right kind of managerial skill sets and the right management team in place to make sure that whatever acquisition you or growth strategy you pursue can be really quickly brought up to efficiency, productivity, and performing what we call best in class. That's really, really important. It's certainly is best and also fairly high on the list to have the financial capacity to either fund it yourself, and most major expansions we don't have the capacity to fund it ourselves, but also have the financial capacity to go to the funding organizations, the banks, et cetera, with a strong financial position so you don't end up overextending yourself, right? And so strong financial strength gives you the capacity not only to handle the downside, but also then to capture opportunities on the upside. We worry a little bit in that context about people who might be incented because they can get good deals compared to 20 years ago in, say, machinery and equipment or building a new bin. We talked to a bin contractor the other day, and he said, I had 9 contracts for major expansions this last year and ended up with only one of them that was built because farmers are concerned about finances, and so they backed away. We need to make sure we don't undercut our financial strength we already have by destroying our working capital position. We got a lot of cash. We need to spend it. We need to go buy something. Well, that maybe worked when we had the good profit margins we had because you knew that cash was going to be replaced in the next crop. That's not going to be replaced at the same level we are today with these prices and incomes, et cetera. So don't destroy your working capital is really, really critical. Then we also basically worked through with the group a whole set of questions about, okay, let's really kind of ask some fundamental questions about growth. Why are you growing? What's the reason you're doing this? Is it because you are trying to get larger and capture size economies, get lower costs so you can buy your inputs at a better price or get more efficient in the use of your current equipment, et cetera? That's what. Are you trying to bring a new family member into the business? That's a really, really good reason. But you may grow differently if you're trying to bring a family member into the business compared to if you're trying to get reduced economies of size. Are you trying to provide some headroom for some key employees that you got a really good person? And you really, really don't want to lose that person. But you're really kind of in a position where you don't have much opportunity to have him advance in the organization. And it happens in agriculture just like it does in other industries that, you know, the person who is really good and isn't going to get a chance to advance, he might go elsewhere. Well, one reason we might want to grow is we want to get – I mean – that's not the only reason we're going to make more money, but we're also going to provide the ability to keep our best people in place, et cetera. So why we're going to grow is a really, really important question to get answered before we go buy a piece of farmland or build a hog barn, et cetera. What are we really trying to accomplish? We also think it's important to answer questions like, where are we? What are we going to do to handle these startup cost problems? Because almost every expansion has a startup problem. And do we have systems in place to be able to monitor and measure and make sure we are, as well as a lender that's willing to help fund us through those startup problems or cash reserves to fund us through those problems? We talk also about the issue of, well, let's be really careful about how we think about growth, because growth isn't necessarily and frequently not the best thing to do initially to grow, to just go get more assets, more buildings, more land, et cetera. You get better at what you're doing. Growth really is getting more revenue And sometimes you get more revenue by doing what you're doing a heck of a lot better. So we talk about what we call two-phase growth analysis, where what you first thing you do in phase one is to focus on doing something very, very, very well. And then you intensify and use your assets in that very, very well. You figure out what you want to do. You do it well, what you can get excited about getting up and doing in the morning. You continue to intensify. You go around with that circle, intensify. You get better. You focus. You do that until you are the very low-cost producer, better than anybody else in the industry in this area. Then you can start thinking about other things that you might want to do to grow your business, whether it might be getting into other parts of the value chain or going buying bigger businesses through a replicate strategy, building another complex of hogs or whatever it might be, or a new dairy facility, et cetera, or expanding your land base. And maybe there what you do is you do what we call the replicate strategy, where you don't just, to your point, you don't just buy another 80 next to you. You actually start a new venture in a new part of the state or a new county, et cetera, a new locale, because you're trying to kind of expand the geographic footprint, because as you start getting bigger in one location, you start competing more aggressively just to get that growth in a market where you've got another guy down the road not too far that's also trying to grow, and so you end up butting heads, paying a lot more rent than you really, really maybe should, because he's also eager and wants to grow. And so sometimes we have to kind of think about our geographic dispersion of that growth process. Do we want to intensify? Do we want to grow by expanding our acreage? So those are the types of things we have to really think about in this process.
Just a couple of minutes left. Tell me how it is that you assess one opportunity against another.
Yeah, so we have about a seven-step process that we go through in that context, and as we indicated, we start out initially with a strategic fit question. Does it really fit strategically? Second thing is, what's the financial performance of this new opportunity? Is it going to, in fact, generate better revenues than any other alternative is? If we don't put that at the top of the list, we put it second, because we think that if it's not a good strategic fit, that we probably will find that the numbers don't crunch very well, right? Then we worry about the cultural fit that we're going to have in this operation. You know, are the people in place going to be able to absorb this, not only absorb it, but they're going to get excited about it? Do we have the staffing and personnel to get it done? Do we? And if we don't, that's not a deal breaker, but it is what's our plan to get that staffing in place. And is there a plan to add a new person to the operation? Or is that possibly a way we get that staffing is to do what we call an M&A strategy? So what we do is we actually acquire some of the resources, human as well as physical, in the acquisition process. So we're going to expand in the pork business and build a new get involved in an operation in terms of trying to be a contractor for one of the new packing plants. Maybe what we do is we buy an already operational pork company and get the management team and pork production company, get the management team in the process. Okay. And then we worry about issues of what's the risk associated with this venture. Is it a risky proposition? Well, all propositions are risky. The question is, what's the risk-reward trade-off in this proposition? And so the question is, okay, we get this kind of return in it, but is that return adequately above what we could get in other operations to reward us for the additional risk we're going to take in this operation? So those are the kinds of things that we kind of look at in terms of the criteria that we ought to consider as we go through the process.
Thanks so much for taking the time with us today.
You bet. I enjoyed it.
Mike Boljay is an agricultural economist for Purdue University. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois. Since 1916, Farm Credit Illinois has been helping farm families succeed, providing farm real estate and operating loans, crop insurance, and point-of-sale financing. Through both the prosperous and challenging economic cycles of agriculture, Farm Credit will support rural Illinois today and tomorrow.
It's National Chip and Dip Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1699, John Bartram was born. An American naturalist and explorer, he is considered the father of American botany. Bartram established a world-renowned botanical garden in Philadelphia in 1728. In 1857, Fanny Merritt Farmer was born. An American culinary authority, she wrote the 1896 edition of the Boston Cooking School Cookbook, which became known in future editions as the Fanny Farmer Cookbook. Farmer was director of the Boston Cooking School and founder of Miss Farmer's School of Cookery, and she is often cited as the first cookbook author to introduce standard measurements. In 1880, John Stevens patented the grain crushing mill. His machine allowed flour production to increase by 70%, making it much more affordable. A barrel of flour crushed by the machine went for $2. Also in 1880, a patent for a glass milk bottle was issued to Warren Glass Works. And in 1912, the Dixie Cup was developed by Lawrence Llewellyn and Hugh Moore. Its original name was the Health Cup, and it changed to the Dixie Cup in 1919. The name came from a line of dolls made by the Dixie Doll Company. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Support for WILL comes from the Friends of WILL and from Busey, giving more than $1 million and countless volunteer hours annually to make a positive difference in our communities. Busey, your dream, our promise.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. This is public radio for the farming world. Coming up, we'll take a look at the history of the soybean. This is the first in a three-part series through the courtesy of retired University of Illinois plant geneticist Ted Heimowitz. We'll go back more than 3,000 years to when Chinese farmers first adapted a wild relative of the bean to cultivation.
The first written record of the soybean dates to the 11th century BC. The plant originated in the wilds of modern-day Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. From these points, it spread first to China in the north, says University of Illinois plant geneticist Ted Heimowitz. There, Chinese farmers adapted the Glycine soja, or the wild annual soybean, for cultivation.
So the farmers of China took this small, black, wild annual and domesticated it. When I say domesticate, what I'm referring to is just two traits they selected for. And those traits were simply upright plants. The wild soja is prostrate, recumbent, tends to trail, climb. And the second was once it was prostrate, straight up, erect, we could then select for large seed size.
Those two traits mark the only difference between the first domesticated soybean and its wild ancestor, and it happened about 3,000 years ago. It wasn't until the 20th century that the next real evolution of the soybean occurred. With the mechanization of agriculture, processors, farmers, and soybean breeders quickly realized another, third trait had to be added to the bean. It shattered at maturity, and this was bad. Farmers needed to be able to harvest the soybeans without having them pop out of the pod before they could be put into the machine.
Okay, so thus the third trait occurred, and that was due to the thrashing mechanization, that the farmers did not want in the United States to bring the soybeans to the thrashing floor, and it would just be a mess. So selection occurred for soybeans that did not shatter. And in a line called CNS, Clemson Non-Shattering, that trait of not shattering was incorporated into all soybeans commercial soybeans now grown in the United States and elsewhere.
So domestication of the soybean started about 3,000 years ago. The first written record comes from the 11th century before Christ. Well, the bean is derived from a wild annual called Glycine soja that looks a bit like a morning glory. It's a viney plant that climbs and trails and produces small, black seeds. It can still be found today. Well, this plant was domesticated by Chinese farmers who made it stand upright and increase the seed size. And then, about 80 years ago, U.S. farmers added a third trait. They bred the soybean so that it wouldn't shatter at harvest. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.